Rather an announcement of disaster. In the grey dawn light, Bedford Forrest struck Murfreesboro with 3 regiments of cavalry, wrecking the railroad at that point and capturing the Federal commander, Brigadier General T.T. Crittenden, together with all his men, guns, and equipment. Stung, Buell reacted fast by hurrying William Nelson's whole division to the scene, but when it got there, the hard-riding Confederate and his captives had disappeared eastward in the direction of the mountains. Nor was that all. The work gangs had barely completed their repairs when, 8 days later, Forrest struck again, this time up near Nashville, where he celebrated the anniversary of Manassas by firing his captured guns within sight of the Capitol Tower and wrecking the 3 bridges across Mill Creek. When Nelson's division marched from Murfreesboro to intercept him, he took a side road, camped for the night within earshot of the bluecoats tramping northward on the pike, then once more made his escape into the mountains beyond McMinnville. Nettled, but not disheartened, Buell put his repair gangs back to work. Within a week, practice having increased their skill, they had the line in operation. July 29th, the first train pulled into Stevenson from Nashville with 210,000 rations, followed next day by another with a comparable amount. The troops went back on full allowances of food, and Nelson's infantry replaced the shoes they had worn out chasing Forrest's cavalry. This was a help and was duly appreciated, but something more than footgear had been damaged in the process, and there were pains in other regions than the stomach. Morale and pride were involved here, too. Buell's men began to consider that, with the doubtful exception of Shiloh, which was not really their fight since they only arrived on the second day, and even then were only engaged in part, the Army of the Ohio was the only major federal command that had never fought a pitched battle on its own. The blame for this, as they saw it, rested with Buell, whose military policy was referred to by one of his colonels as that of a dancing master. "By your leave, my dear sir, we will have a fight, that is, if you are sufficiently fortified. No hurry, take your time." Distasteful as this was to the men, there was something else about their commander that irked them even more. When Ormsby Mitchell's division came through this region back in May, one soldier wrote happily in his diary, "Our boys find Alabama hams better than Uncle Sam's side meat and fresh bread better than hard crackers." Buell, on the other hand, not only put them on half rations, but issued and enforced stern orders against foraging, which he believed would discourage Southern civilians from returning to their old allegiance. However true this was or wasn't, it seemed to the men that he was less concerned with their hunger pangs than he was with the comfort and welfare of the rebels, who, after all, were to blame for their being down here in the first place. Also, he was denying them the fun and profit enjoyed by comrades who had come this way before them. For example, in reprisal for guerrilla activities, one of Mitchell's brigade commanders, Colonel John Basil Turchin, formerly Ivan Vasilievich Turchininov of the Imperial Russian Army, had turned the town of Athens over to his 3 regiments, saying, "I shut mine eyes for 1 hour." Whereupon the Illinois, Ohio, and Indiana boys took it completely apart, Cossack style, raping Negro servant girls and stuffing their pockets and haversacks with $50,000 worth of watches, plate, and jewelry. Grudgingly, Buell's men complained that he would never turn them loose like that, despite the fact that officially it would apparently do his career far more good than harm. Turchin was court-martialed and dismissed for the Athens debauch, but before the summer was over he was reinstated and promoted to brigadier. Likewise Mitchell, though he was called to Washington in early July to explain illegal cotton transactions made in his department, was promoted to major general and transferred to the mild, sea-scented atmosphere of coastal South Carolina, where, unfortunately, he died of yellow fever in October. Actually, though, the trouble with Buell lay deeper. It was not so much what he did as what he was. Other generals shared his views on the subject of foraging and enforced them quite as sternly. Notably McClellan, and at the present stage of the conflict, Sherman. This demoralizing and disgraceful practice of pillage must cease, the West Tennessee commander admonished his troops in a general order, else the country will rise on us and justly shoot us down like dogs or wild beasts. In fact, on the face of it, both were harder on offenders than Buell ever was or tried to be. In Sherman's command, for example, the punishment for molesting civilians or stealing was confinement on bread and water, and he sent out patrols with instructions to shoot if foragers tried to escape arrest. But they gave their men something instead. Better situated, they fed better, and they moved among their soldiers in a way that made the individual feel that, outside battle, his comfort and well-being were his general's main concern. Above all, in their different ways, they had a flair for the dramatic. McClellan's men would turn from their first hot meal in days for a chance to cheer him riding past, and Sherman could make a soldier proud for weeks by asking him for a light for his cigar. It was personal, a matter of personality. Buell was seldom personal and never at all in public. In private, he had a parlor trick which he sometimes performed to amaze his guests with the strength of his rather stubby arms and his stocky, close-knit torso. Grasping his 140-pound wife by the waist, he would lift her straight out before him, hold her there with her feet dangling clear of the carpet, then perch her deftly on the mantelpiece. It was a good trick, and it won him the admiration of those who watched him do it. But the soldiers never saw this side of his nature. He was a headquarters general, anyhow. They saw him only briefly as he made his hurried, sour-mouthed inspections, peering at them with his beady eyes and poking his hawk-beak nose into unexpected corners. The good he took for granted. It was the less good he was looking for, and he seldom failed to find it. As a result, there was an absence of warmth, and an absence, too, of incidents in which men let their food grow cold while they took time out to cheer him riding by, or fished in their pockets for a light for his cigar. They were well drilled, beyond question. 3 months ago, their professional tone had been such that when Grant's skulkers saw them march ashore at Shiloh, they had cried, "Here come the regulars!" Under fire next day, their confident demeanor as they rolled the rebels back had sustained the basic accuracy of this mistake. Since then, however, a great deal had happened, and all of it bad. The inchworm advance on Corinth, with empty earthworks at the end, had been followed by these two belt-tightening months in North Alabama, where they observed with disgust, as if by a process of unnatural reversion, a butterfly were to have its wings refolded and be stuffed unceremoniously back into its cocoon, their transformation from happy-go-lucky soldiers into ill-fed railroad workers. Out of this had come a loss of former gladness and a suspicion that they had lost their fighting edge. This might or might not be the case, but at any rate the signs had been increasing that a test was about to come. Bragg was not only on the move, both Grant and Rosecrans reported him moving eastward in the direction of Chattanooga. Before Halleck left for Washington in mid-July, he released Thomas to Buell's control, bringing his total strength to 46,000, exclusive of the force at Cumberland Gap. Of these, however, 15,000 were needed for guarding Nashville and the railroads, which left him no more than 31,000 for a forward move. For 2 weeks, the advance had been stalled by the lack of a bridge across the Tennessee at Bridgeport. Lumber for the pontoons had been cut by now, but there was still a shortage of nails, oakum, and pitch. While waiting for them, Buell was doing his best to build up a forward supply depot from which to feed and equip his men when they crossed the river to close in on the city. He was still at it on the last day of July when a message reached his Huntsville headquarters from the commander of his advance division, reporting that Bragg himself had arrived in Chattanooga 2 days ago, apparently in advance of his whole army. On the same evening, two trains came in with soldiers. Railroad agent says he has orders to furnish cars for 30,000 as fast as he can. Informed of this, Halleck replied that Grant would furnish reinforcements if you should find the enemy too strong. 6 days later, learning that Bragg's troops had not yet come up, he prodded Buell again. "There is great dissatisfaction here, in Washington, at the slow movement of your army toward Chattanooga. It is feared that the enemy will have time to concentrate his entire army against you." Buell wired back, "It is difficult to satisfy impatience, and when it proceeds from anxiety, as I know it does in this case, I am not disposed to complain of it. My advance has not been rapid, but it could not be more rapid under the circumstances. I know I have not been idle nor indifferent." Next day, August 7th, he got down to specifics. "The Confederate force in East Tennessee was estimated at 60,000 men," he said. "Yet I am prepared to find the reports much more exaggerated than I have supposed, and shall march upon Chattanooga at the earliest possible day, unless I ascertain certainly that the enemy's strength renders it imprudent. If, on the other hand, he should cross the river, I shall attack him, and I do not doubt that we shall defeat him." Encouraged, Halleck replied that Grant had been ordered to transfer 2 divisions to the Army of the Ohio if they were needed. But he cautioned Buell, "Do not ask for them if you can avoid it with safety." With that, the roof fell in, quite literally. John Morgan had left Kentucky in late July, but now he suddenly reappeared in Middle Tennessee. On August 12th, he captured the guard at Gallatin, above Nashville, and wrecked the L&N Railroad by pushing blazing boxcars into the 800-foot tunnel 7 miles north of there, so that the timbers burned and let the dirt cave in. Unplugging it would be a long-term, if not an impossible, job, and with the Cumberland River too low for shipping, Buell was cut off from his main supply base at Louisville, which meant that his army would have to eat up the rations collected at Stevenson for the intended drive on Chattanooga. Learning next that a Confederate force estimated at 15,000 men had left Knoxville, bound for Nashville and other points in his rear, he called for the 2 divisions from Grant, and on the 16th detached William Nelson to go to Kentucky with a cadre of experienced officers to organize such troops as could be got together there to reestablish our communications and operate against Morgan's incursions. Nor was that all, for the pressure came from various directions, including Washington. 2 days later, when Halleck threatened to fire him if he did not speed up his operations, "So great is the dissatisfaction here at the apparent want of energy and activity in your district that I was this morning notified to have you removed. I got the matter delayed till we could hear further of your movements." Buell replied forthrightly, "I beg that you will not interpose on my behalf. On the contrary, if the dissatisfaction cannot cease on grounds which I think might be supposed, if not apparent, I respectfully request that I may be relieved. My position is far too important to be occupied by any officer on sufferance. I have no desire to stand in the way of what may be deemed necessary for the public good." Either he was past caring, or else he recognized a bluff when he saw one. At any rate, whatever satisfaction this gave him, he had only a short time to enjoy it. Next morning, August 19th, he learned that Bragg's army was crossing the river in force at Chattanooga. This was the eventuality in which he had said, "I shall attack him." But now that he was faced with the actual thing, it began to seem to him that his first responsibility was the protection of Nashville, lying exposed in his rear. Accordingly, he shifted his headquarters to Deckard, 40 miles northeast on the railroad leading back to the capital. 4 days later, by which time Bragg was reported to have crossed the Tennessee with 50 regiments, well-armed and with good artillery, he had made up his mind. Orders went to the commanders of the 2 divisions on their way from Grant. They were to change direction and move by forced marches on Nashville. Simultaneously, the officer in charge of the advance depot at Stevenson was told to expedite the shipment of stores in every possible way and be ready to evacuate the place at a moment's notice. The work of nailing and caulking the floats for the 1,400-yard-long span at Bridgeport had been completed 2 weeks before, and this too was remembered. Let engineers quietly prepare the pontoons for burning, and when you leave, destroy everything that cannot be brought away. Presently, like the campaign itself, the unused bridge went up in smoke. Don Carlos won't do, he won't do, one division commander muttered when he received the order to retire. Others protested likewise, but to no avail. Before the end of August, the withdrawal was complete, and the Deckard Provost Marshal, describing himself as weak, discouraged, and worn out, recorded in his diary, "The whole army is concentrated here or near here, but nobody knows anything, except that the water is bad, whiskey scarce, dust abundant, and the air loaded with the scent and melody of a thousand mules." 3. Having accomplished Buell's repulse without the firing of a shot on either side, except in his rear when Forrest and Morgan were on the rampage, Bragg now turned his mind to larger prospects, involving nothing less than the upset and reversal of the entire military situation in the enormous theater lying between the Appalachians and the Mississippi, the Ohio and the Gulf of Mexico. The actual movement which placed him in a position to accomplish this design had been undertaken as the result of a decision reached on the spur of a moment in late July, specifically the anniversary of Manassas. Before that, he had spent a month reorganizing and refitting the army he inherited when Beauregard left Tupelo for what he thought would be a 10-day convalescence. It had been no easy job. After the long retreat, the troops were badly in need of almost everything, including rest. What they needed most, however, was discipline, or so Bragg told the brave men of Shiloh and of Elkhorn in an address issued on June 27th, the date of his official appointment to command the Army of the Mississippi. "I enter hopefully on my duties," he declared, "but soldiers, to secure the legitimate results of all your heavy sacrifices which have brought this army together, to infuse that unity and cohesion essential for a resolute resistance to the wicked invasion of our country, and to give to serried ranks force, impetus, and direction for driving the invader beyond our borders, be assured discipline at all times and obedience to the orders of your officers on all points as a sacred duty, an act of patriotism, is an absolute necessity." Great events were impending. "A few more days of needful preparation and organization, and I shall give your banners to the breeze, with the confident trust that you will gain additional honors to those you have already won on other fields." After much that was turgid, he ended grimly, "But be prepared to undergo privation and labor with cheerfulness and alacrity." Cheerfulness was by no means a primary characteristic of this sixth among the Confederacy's full generals. Dyspepsia and migraine had made him short-tempered and disputatious all his life. In the old army, there was a story that in his younger days, as a lieutenant commanding one of several companies at a post where he was also serving as quartermaster, he had submitted a requisition for supplies, then as quartermaster had declined by endorsement to fill it. As company commander, he resubmitted the requisition, giving additional reasons for his needs, but as quartermaster he persisted in denial. Having reached this impasse, he referred the matter to the post commandant, who took one look at the correspondence and threw up his hands. "My God, Mr. Bragg, you have quarreled with every officer in the army, and now you are quarreling with yourself." Other stories were less humorous, as, for instance, that one of his soldiers had attempted to assassinate him not long after the Mexican War by exploding a 12-pound shell under his cot. When the smoke cleared away, the cot was reduced to tatters and kindling, but Bragg himself emerged without a scratch. He had left the army in 1856 for a civilian career, not in his native North Carolina, but as a sugar planter and commissioner of swamp lands in Louisiana. With the coming of the present war, which he believed had been brought on by such ill-advised political measures as the extension of universal suffrage, he had sustained his former reputation as a disciplinarian and a fighter by whipping his Gulf Coast command rapidly into a state of efficiency and leading it aggressively at Shiloh. There, he said in his report immediately afterwards, the army had been given a valuable lesson by which we should profit. Never on a battlefield to lose a moment's time, but leaving the killed, wounded, and spoils to those whose special business it is to care for them, to press on with every available man, giving a panic-stricken and retreating foe no time to rally, and reaping all the benefits of success never complete until every enemy is killed, wounded, or captured. He was now in a position, with the approval of the authorities in Richmond, to give this precept large-scale application. After informing him on June 29th that his department had been extended so as to embrace that part of Louisiana east of the Mississippi, the entire states of Mississippi and Alabama, and the portion of Georgia and Florida west of the Chattahoochee and Apalachicola rivers, Secretary Randolph not only authorized an offensive, but urged him to strike the moment an opportunity offers. That was what Bragg had already told his soldiers he intended to do as soon as he had completed the reorganization in progress. However, this was attended by many difficulties. One problem, beyond the need for restoring, or Bragg would say injecting, discipline, was the army's health. The troops had brought their Corinth ailments with them. Including the men from the Trans-Mississippi, the July 1st aggregate present of 61,561 was reduced to 45,393 by deduction of those who were sick or in arrest or on extra duty. Healthier conditions at Tupelo, plus the absence of strain, the nearest bluecoat was 2 days off, would restore a good part of these 16,000 soldiers to the ranks. More serious, as Bragg thought, was the shortage of competent high-ranking officers. Van Dorn was gone, transferred to Vicksburg in mid-June when Davis and Farragut threatened the city from above and below. Breckinridge went with him, taking 6,000 troops to oppose a landing by the men from Butler, and Hindman was detached at the same time to raise an army in Arkansas. Polk, having been relieved of his corps and named second in command of the whole, Hardee and Price were the only experienced major generals left in direct charge of troops. The rest, Bragg told Richmond, including most of the brigadiers in the sweeping indictment, were, in my judgment, unsuited for their responsible positions, were, in fact, only encumbrances and would be better out of the way. Despite these shortcomings, and despite the fact that the War Department increased his difficulties by not allowing him to consolidate understrength regiments bled wide at Shiloh, then further reduced to skeletons by pestilence at Corinth, he kept his army hard at work, convinced that this was the sovereign remedy for injured health as well as for injured discipline. In compensation for long hours of drill, he issued new uniforms and better rations, both of which had an additional salutary effect. New problems were dealt with as they arose, including an upsurge of desertion. He met it harshly. Almost every day we would hear a discharge of musketry and knew that some poor trembling wretch had bid farewell to mortal things here below, one soldier afterwards recalled. The effectiveness of such executions was increased, Bragg believed, by lining up the condemned man's former comrades to watch him pay for his crime. It worked. Desertion decreased, but at a price. We were crushed, the same observer added bitterly. Bragg, so the soldiers thought, was the machine that did it. He loved to crush the spirit of his men. The more of a hangdog look they had about them, the better was General Bragg pleased. Not a single soldier in the whole army ever loved or respected him. True or false, all this was rather beside the point as far as Bragg was concerned. He was not out after love or respect, he was after results, and he got them. On July 12th, he informed the adjutant general that the time since his last report, forwarded to Richmond when he assumed official command 2 weeks before, has been diligently applied to organization, discipline, and instruction, with a very marked improvement. The health and general tone of the troops, too, exhibits results no less gratifying. Our condition for service is good, and has reached a culminating point under the defective skeleton organization. He was ready to strike. The question was, where? In what direction? Grant's army, considerably larger than his own and occupying strong positions under Sherman and Rosecrans at Memphis and Corinth, seemed practically unassailable. Besides which, Bragg told Richmond, a long and disastrous drought threatening destruction to the grain crop continues here and renders any move into North Mississippi impracticable for want of water. As for Buell, his lateral advance had been so slow and apparently so uncertain that for a long time the Confederates had found it impossible to determine his objective. It might be Chattanooga. In that case, Bragg had already sent a 3,000-man brigade of infantry to reinforce the troops in East Tennessee. Or it might be Atlanta, depending on what direction he took after crossing the river at Bridgeport. Whichever it was, Bragg decided in mid-July to give him all the trouble he could by sending two brigades of cavalry, under Colonel Joseph Wheeler and Brigadier General Frank Armstrong, to harass his lines of supply and communication in West Tennessee and North Alabama. They had excellent models for their work, commanders who had already given cavalry operations, and indeed the war itself, a new dimension, based on their proof that sizable bodies of hard-riding men could not only strike and create havoc deep in the enemy's rear, Jeb Stuart style, but could stay there to strike again and again, spreading the havoc over hundreds of miles and wearing out their would-be pursuers by causing them to converge repeatedly on thin air. By now, the whole Confederate West was ringing with praise for Morgan and Forrest, particularly the former, whose exploits had surrounded him with the aura of a legend. A tall, white-faced, handsome, cold-eyed man, soft-spoken and always neatly dressed in conservative but obviously expensive clothes, fine gray broadcloth, fire-gilt buttons, richly polished boots, and spotless linen. He knew the effectiveness of reticence, yet he could be flamboyant on occasion. "Kentuckians," he exhorted in a broadside struck off at Glasgow and distributed on his sweep through the bluegrass, "I have come to liberate you from the hands of your oppressors." Calling for volunteer recruits, 50,000 of Kentucky's bravest sons, and implying thereby that he would take only the bravest, he broke into verse. "Strike for your altars and your fires, strike for the green graves of your sires, God and your native land." He was seldom flamboyant, however, except for a purpose. For example, he carried with him a telegrapher, a wiretap expert, who, though he would sometimes chat waggishly with enemy operators, once he even went so far as to complain directly to Washington in Morgan's name about the inferior grade of mules being furnished Buell's army, not only intercepted messages that kept his chief informed of the federal efforts to surround him, but also sent out false instructions that turned the converging blue columns off his trail. Such devices yielded profits, leaving Knoxville on July 4th with fewer than 900 men. He made a 1,000-mile swing through Middle Tennessee and Kentucky, in the course of which he captured 17 towns, together with tons of Union supplies, paroled nearly 1,200 regular Army prisoners, and dispersed about 1,500 home guarders, all at a cost of less than 90 casualties, and returned before the end of the month with an additional 300 volunteers picked up along the way. 2 weeks later, he was back again. Lest it be thought that he was merely a hit-and-run sort of soldier, after wrecking the Gallatin Tunnel, he turned on his pursuer, Brigadier General R.W. Johnson, a West Pointer and fellow Kentuckian, whom Buell had assigned the task of intercepting the raiders with an equal force, and whipped him soundly, breaking up his command and capturing the general and his staff. Forrest was a different sort of man, different in method, that is, if not in results. Recuperating in Memphis from his fallen timbers wound, The ball had lodged against his spine and was removed in the field a week later without the benefit of an anesthetic. He put a recruiting notice in the local paper calling for able-bodied men with good horse and gun. "I wish none but those who desire to be actively engaged. Come on, boys, if you want a heap of fun and to kill some Yankees." When he returned to Corinth, shortly before the evacuation, Beauregard sent him to Chattanooga with orders to weld the scattered East Tennessee cavalry units into a brigade. He arrived in late June, assembled his men, and, believing active duty the best possible training for a Green command, crossed the Tennessee River on July 9th to camp the following night atop Cumberland Mountain, deep in enemy territory. At dawn Sunday, 3 mornings later, and 90 roundabout miles away, civilian hostages held in the Murfreesboro jail, several were under sentence of death in retaliation for the bushwhacking of Union soldiers on or near their farms, heard what one of them later called a strange noise like the roar of an approaching storm. It was hoofbeats. Forrest's 1,400 troopers were pounding up the turnpike. 2 regiments of infantry, one from Michigan, one from Minnesota, each with a section of artillery and cavalry support. Their combined strength was about the same as Forrest's, except that he had no guns. Were camped on opposite sides of town, with detachments guarding the jail and the courthouse, in which the brigade supplies were stored. Quickly, the town was taken along with the federal commanding general, and firefights broke out on the outskirts, where the Blue Infantry prepared to defend its camps. Once the hostages had been freed and the captured goods packed for removal along with the prisoners already taken, some of the raiders, believing the alarm had spread to other Union garrisons by now, suggested withdrawal. But Forrest would have none of that. "I didn't come here to make half a job of it," he said, influenced perhaps by the fact that today was his 41st birthday. "I'm going to have them all." He got them, too, though he hastened matters somewhat by sending notes to the 2 commanders in their barricaded camps, demanding, "Unconditional surrender, or I will have every man put to the sword." He added, by way of extenuation and persuasion, "This demand is made to prevent the effusion of blood." And though, like Morgan, he was still a colonel, in his signature he promoted himself to Brigadier General of Cavalry, C.S. Army, doubtless to lend additional weight to the threat. It worked. The 2 blue colonels surrendered in sequence, and Forrest marched his 1,200 prisoners back eastward to McMinnville, where he paroled them and forwarded the captured arms and supplies to Chattanooga, all but the guns. He kept them for use around Nashville the following week, where he gave Nelson the slip after re-wrecking Buell's vital railroad supply line. "I am happy to see that my 2 lieutenants, Morgan and Forrest, are doing such good service in Kentucky and Tennessee," Beauregard wrote from Bladen Springs, where he was still in exile. "When I appointed them, I thought they would leave their mark wherever they passed." This was said in reply to a letter from Bragg in which the present army commander told his former chief, "Our cavalry is paving the way for me in Middle Tennessee and Kentucky." The letter was dated July 22nd. By that time, Bragg had decided not only on Buell's intentions, but also on his own. After a 40-day federal head start, it was to be a race for Chattanooga, with further possibilities as the prize. Kirby Smith, commanding in East Tennessee, had never had much doubt about Buell's intentions from the outset. Promoted to Major General after recovering from being shot through the neck at Manassas, Smith had been given the thorny job of restoring order in the area around Knoxville. And in this he had succeeded remarkably well, considering the extent to which the region was torn by conflicting loyalties and ambitions. But since the fall of Corinth, the military situation had grown increasingly ominous. George Morgan occupied Cumberland Gap, an immediate threat to Knoxville itself, and Buell began his eastward advance in the direction of Chattanooga, while Smith himself had less than 15,000 of all arms with which to resist the 2-pronged menace. The arrival of the 3,000-man brigade from Bragg afforded some relief, but not for long. Learning from northern papers in mid-July that several of Grant's divisions had been released to Buell, he protested to Davis in Richmond, "This brings an overwhelming force that cannot be resisted except by Bragg's cooperation." 4 days later, July 19th, he reported to the adjutant general that Buell, with his whole force, had reached Stevenson, 30 miles from Chattanooga, which he was daily expected to attack. Fortunately, Smith added, Forrest had broken the Union supply line at Murfreesboro. This may delay General Buell's movement and give General Bragg time to move on Middle Tennessee. The safety of Chattanooga depends upon his cooperation. Next day, not knowing of his opponent's difficulties in procuring pitch and oakum, he made a telegraphic appeal to Bragg himself. "Buell has completed his preparations, is prepared to cross near Bridgeport, and his passage there may be hourly expected. General Morgan's command moving on Knoxville from Cumberland Gap. Your cooperation is much needed. It is your time to strike at Middle Tennessee." Bragg's reply, sent from Tupelo that same day, was not encouraging. "Confronted here by a largely superior force, strongly entrenched, and threatened on the left by Curtis, who would now be enabled to unite against us, he found it impossible to do more than menace and harass the enemy from this quarter." The land was parched. Both armies, Grant's and his own, were living out of wells, so that whichever ventured far from its base in search of the other would die of thirst. "The fact is, we are fearfully outnumbered in this department, the enemy having at least 2 to our 1 in the field, with a comparatively short line upon which he may concentrate." After this recital of obstacles and woes, he made it clear that Smith would have to shift for himself in East Tennessee, without the hope of further reinforcements. Then overnight he changed his mind. Next day was the anniversary of Manassas, and he saluted it with a telegram as abruptly brief as the discharge of a starting gun in the race, which it announced. "Tupelo, Mississippi, July 21st. President Jefferson Davis, Richmond, Virginia. We'll move immediately to Chattanooga in force and advance from there. Forward movement from here in force is not practicable. We'll leave this line well defended. Braxton Bragg." Next day, in the midst of large-scale preparations for the shift, he was not waiting for specific governmental approval. "Strike the moment an opportunity offers," he had been told 3 weeks ago. He expanded this somewhat in a second wire to Davis, who he knew must have been startled at being told, without preamble, that the army which was the mainstay of his native Mississippi was being removed forthwith. "Obstacles in front connected with danger to Chattanooga induce a change of base. Fully impressed with great importance of that line, am moving to East Tennessee. Produce rapid offensive from there following the consternation now being produced by our cavalry. Leave this state amply protected by Van Dorn at Vicksburg and Price here." In a letter to Beauregard that same day, the one in which he wrote, "Our cavalry is paving the way," he gave a fuller explanation. "As I am changing entirely under altered circumstances the plan of operations here," he told his former chief, "I submit to you what I propose and beg your candid criticism, and in view of the cordial and sincere relations we have ever maintained, I trust to your compliance. With Smith, so weak as to give me great uneasiness for the safety of his line, Bragg had had to choose between 4 alternatives. 1, to remain idle at Tupelo. 2, to attack Grant. 3, to move into Middle Tennessee by crossing the river in Buell's rear and thus disrupt his and Grant's supply lines, or 4, to attack Buell. Of these, the first was unthinkable, the second was impracticable, considering the drought in North Mississippi and the strength of the fortifications at Memphis and Corinth. The third was unwise and over-risky, since it would invite both Grant and Buell to assault him simultaneously from opposite directions. Therefore, he had chosen the 4th, which would not only provide for a combination with Smith, but would also afford possibilities for maneuver and mystification. By throwing my cavalry forward toward Grand Junction and Tuscumbia, this referred to Wheeler and Armstrong, who had left 3 days ago, the impression is created that I am advancing on both places, and the Federals are drawing in to meet me. The Memphis and Charleston road has been kept cut, so they have no use of it and have at length given it up. Before they can know my movement, I shall be in front of Buell at Chattanooga, and by cutting off his transportation may have him in a tight place. Thus you have my plan. As might have been expected, for though it lacked the language, it had nearly the grandeur of one of the Creole's own, Beauregard gave the plan his fervent approval. "Action, action, and action is what we require," he replied, paraphrasing Danton's "De l'audace, encore l'audace, et toujours de l'audace," and added with a paternalistic glow, "I have no doubt that with anything like equal numbers you will meet with success." By the time these encouraging words reached him, however, Bragg was far from Tupelo. He left on July 24th after notifying the adjutant general, "Major General Van Dorn, with about 16,000 effectives, will hold the line of the Mississippi. Major General Price, with a similar force, will face the enemy on this frontier, and a sufficient garrison will be left from Mobile and the Gulf. With the balance of the forces, some 35,000 effectives, I hope, in conjunction with Major General Smith, to strike an effective blow through Middle Tennessee, gaining the enemy's rear, cutting off his supplies, and dividing his forces, so as to encounter him in detail. In any event, much will be accomplished in simply preserving our line and preventing a descent into Georgia, than which no greater disaster could befall us." His confidence that he would win the race, despite the handicap of a 6-week lag, not to mention the sobering example of the hare and tortoise fable, was based on an appreciation of railroads as a strategic factor in this war. For one thing, by bringing Joe Johnston's men down from the valley through Manassas Gap to unload within earshot of the Union guns, they had won the battle whose anniversary had now come round. Ever since his assumption of command, Bragg had kept busy, doing not only all he could to wreck Buell's rail facilities, but also all he could to improve his own, especially in urging the completion of a line connecting Meridian and Selma. In the former effort, by grace of Morgan and Forrest, he had been successful, but in the latter, he had failed. The Confederacy, it appeared, could afford neither the effort nor the iron. Consequently, with the Memphis and Charleston wrecked and in federal hands, the only rail connection between Tupelo and Chattanooga was a roundabout far south route through Mobile and Atlanta, involving a journey of 776 miles over no less than half a dozen separate railroads, with through trains prohibited by the water gap across Mobile Bay and the narrow gauge of the Montgomery and West Point Road. Nevertheless, the sending of the 3,000-man brigade to Smith in late June as a trial run over this route had opened Bragg's eyes to the possibilities it afforded for a rapid large-scale movement. The troops had left Tupelo on June 27th, and despite congestion all along the line, conflicting orders from Richmond had put other units simultaneously on the rails, reached Chattanooga on July 3rd, within a week of the day the movement order had been issued. Now he was out to repeat or better the performance with 10 times as many soldiers, the effective total of his 4 divisions being 31,638 of all arms. Horse-drawn elements, including engineers and wagon trains, as well as cavalry and artillery, would move overland, due east to Rome, then north, but the bulk of the command would go by rail, dispatched from Tupelo a division at a time. For this, though they were made on quite short notice, the preparations were extensive, with the emphasis on discipline, as was always the case when Bragg was in charge. Each man was to be handed 7 days' cooked rations as he stepped aboard, thus forestalling any excuse for foraging en route, and unit commanders were cautioned to be especially vigilant at junction points to prevent the more adventurous from disrupting the schedule by stealing away for a visit to the fleshpots. The 1st Division left on July 23rd, the 2nd and 3rd immediately thereafter, and the 4th on July 29th, by which time the units forwarded from Mobile and other scattered points to clear the line had been in Chattanooga for 2 full days. They were followed by a week-long procession of jam-packed cars whose engines came puffing around Missionary Ridge and into the city. In all the bustle and hurry of preparation and departure, and in spite of the number of wires and letters flying back and forth, Bragg had neglected to mention his sudden volte-face to the one person most immediately concerned, Kirby Smith. While changing trains in Montgomery, however, he was handed an intercepted letter the East Tennessee commander had sent from Knoxville on the 24th, the day Bragg left Tupelo, proposing, with what amounted to clairvoyance, if not downright telepathy, the very movement now in progress. Buell's movements and preparations indicate a speedy attack. Can you not leave a portion of your forces in observation in Mississippi and, shifting the main body to this department, take command in person? There is yet time for a brilliant summer campaign. You will have a good and secure base, abundant supplies. The Tennessee can be crossed at any point by the aid of steam and ferry boats. And the campaign opened with every prospect of regaining possession of Middle Tennessee and possibly Kentucky. He added, I will not only cooperate with you, but will cheerfully place my command under you, subject to your orders. With this in his pocket, a happy omen as well as an affirmation of his strategic judgment, Bragg continued his journey and reached Chattanooga early on the morning of July 30th. Informed of his arrival, Smith came down from Knoxville the following day to confer with him on what Bragg called measures for material support and effective cooperation. Smith had two divisions, one in front of Cumberland Gap, observing the Federals who occupied that point, the other at Chattanooga. Their strength was about 9,000 men each, including the brigade that had arrived 4 weeks ago to thicken the ranks of the slim force confronting Buell. Bragg was reorganizing his still-arriving army into two wings, one under Polk, the other under Hardee, each with two infantry divisions and a cavalry brigade. Their combined strength was 34,000, including the units forwarded in driblets from points along the railroad. His problem was how best to employ these 52,000 men, his and Smith's, against the larger but badly scattered Federal forces to his front and on his flank. The solution, as communicated to the Adjutant General on August 1st, was for Smith to move at once against General Morgan in front of Cumberland Gap, while Bragg was collecting supplies and awaiting the arrival of his artillery and trains for an advance from Chattanooga. This would require 10 days or 2 weeks, he said. At the end of that time, if Smith had been successful against Morgan, both armies would then combine for a march into Middle Tennessee with the fairest prospect of cutting off General Buell, should that commander continue in his present position. Should he be reinforced from the west side of the Tennessee River so as to cope with us, then Van Dorn and Price can strike and clear West Tennessee of any force that can be left to hold it. Furthermore, once Grant and Buell had been disposed of, either by destruction or by being maneuvered into retreat, he considered the time propitious for an invasion of the region to the north. The feeling in Middle Tennessee and Kentucky is represented by Forrest and Morgan to have become intensely hostile to the enemy, and nothing is wanted but arms and support to bring the people into our ranks, for they have found that neutrality has afforded them no protection. Returning to Knoxville, much encouraged by these developments, Smith informed his wife that he had found his new partner a grim old fellow. He himself was 38, Bragg was 45, but a true soldier. Presently, he was further gladdened by the arrival of two brigades detached by Bragg to reinforce him for the offensive, one from Polk and one from Hardee, and being thus strengthened on the eve of his advance, he began to see larger prospects looming out beyond the horizon, prospects based in part on a dispatch from John Morgan, who had reported from northern Kentucky in mid-July, I am here with a force sufficient to hold all the country outside of Lexington and Frankfort. These places are garrisoned chiefly with home guards. The bridges between Cincinnati and Lexington have been destroyed. The whole country can be secured, and 25,000 or 30,000 men will join you at once. I've taken 11 cities and towns with very heavy army stores. If one small brigade of cavalry could accomplish all this, Smith reasoned, what might a whole army do? Accordingly, on August 9th, he wrote to Bragg that he understood the Federals entrenched at Cumberland Gap had nearly a month's supply of provisions. If this be true, the reduction of the place would be a matter of more time than I presume you are willing I should take. as my move direct to Lexington, Kentucky would effectually invest the gap and would be attended with other most brilliant results in my judgment. I suggest my being allowed to take that course if I find the speedy reduction of the gap an impractical thing. Bragg, too, was nurturing hopes in that direction, though not without reservations. He replied next day, "It will be a week yet before I can commence crossing the river, and information I hope to receive will determine which route I shall take, to Nashville or Lexington. My inclination is now for the latter." All the same, Smith's plan to bypass Cumberland Gap and head straight for north-central Kentucky was more than his partner had bargained for, even though Smith reinforced his proposal by enclosing a letter from John Morgan's lieutenant colonel, stressing the opinion that flocks of eager volunteers were waiting to double the size of his army as soon as it reached the Bluegrass. Strategically, Bragg approved, but tactically he urged caution. "It would be unadvisable, I think, for you to move far into Kentucky, leaving George Morgan in your rear until I am able to fully engage Buell and his forces on your left. But I do not credit the amount of Morgan's supplies at Cumberland Gap, and have confidence in his timidity. When once well on the way to his rear, you might safely leave but 5,000 to his front, and by a flank movement draw the rest to your assistance. He will never advance to escape." Smith's ebullience was contagious, as was shown in the final sentence of Bragg's letter. "Van Dorn and Price will advance simultaneously with us from Mississippi on West Tennessee, and I trust we may all unite in Ohio." Just now, however, Van Dorn was looking south, not north. He had New Orleans on his mind, not Ohio. The grim determination he had brought to embattled Vicksburg in late June. "Let it be borne in mind by all that the army here is defending the place against occupation. This will be done at all hazards, even though this beautiful and devoted city should be laid in ruin and ashes," gave way to elation in mid-July when the Arkansas made her run through the Yankee sloops and gunboats. "Glorious for the Navy and glorious for her heroic commander, officers, and men," he wired Davis. The Iron Ram changed everything. "Smokestack riddled, otherwise not materially damaged," he exulted. "Soon be repaired and then ho for New Orleans." Both enemy fleets were still on hand, and across the way the Bluecoats were still digging their canal, but Van Dorn no longer saw them as much of a threat. A week later, after two all-out attempts to sink the Arkansas under the tall red bluff, he pronounced the failure so complete that it was almost ridiculous. The same went for the engineering project. "Nothing can be accomplished by the enemy," he told Richmond, "unless they bring overwhelming number of troops. This must be anticipated." His favorite method of anticipation, now as always, was to seize the offensive, to snatch the ball from his opponent and start running. That was what he had done or tried to do in Arkansas back in the early spring, and that was what he decided to do now in his native Mississippi in midsummer. When Davis and Farragut gave up the game, turned their backs on each other, and went their separate ways, the former to Helena, the latter to New Orleans after dropping the infantry off at Baton Rouge, Van Dorn ordered Breckinridge to pursue southward with 4,000 men and knock the Bluecoats off balance in the Louisiana capital before they could get set for a return. If possible, he was to take the city, after which, as Van Dorn saw it, would come much else. 5 months ago the byword had been St. Louis, then huzzah. Now it was ho for New Orleans. Breckinridge wasted no time in getting started. On July 27th, the day after the Yankee fleets took off in opposite directions, he put his troops aboard railroad cars and proceeded by way of Jackson to Ponchatoula, Louisiana, where they detrained the following afternoon to prepare for the overland advance on Baton Rouge, 60 miles to the west. On the 30th, the march began, but was halted the following morning when reports came in that the effective force of the enemy was not less than 5,000, and that the ground was commanded by three gunboats lying in the river. Down to 3,400 men as a result of sickness, Breckinridge wired Van Dorn that he would nonetheless undertake to capture the garrison if the Arkansas could be sent down to clear the river or divert the fire of the gunboats. Promptly, the reply came back. The ram would be in front of Baton Rouge at dawn, August 5th. Breckinridge made his plans accordingly. Isaac Brown was not in Vicksburg at the time, having left his shipmates to sustain without me the lassitude of inaction while he took a 4-day leave in Grenada. If rest and relaxation were what he was after, which was probable, he had had precious little of either in the past 2 months, he was disappointed in more ways than one. For one thing, he had no sooner arrived than he was taken violently ill and put to bed. For another, while he was in this condition, supposedly unable to lift his head off the pillow, he received a wire from his first lieutenant, informing him that the Arkansas was under orders to proceed at once to Baton Rouge, despite the fact that her engines were under major repair and much of her rusty plating had still not been refastened to her battered sides. Brown replied with a positive order to remain at Vicksburg until I could join him, and had himself carried to the depot where he boarded the first southbound train. Collapsed on some mail bags, too weak to sit up or even change his position, he rode the 130 miles to Jackson, where he applied for a special train to take him the rest of the way, only to learn that the Arkansas had already gone downriver. She cast off Sunday evening, August 3rd, barely 30 hours before she was due at her Tuesday morning rendezvous with Breckinridge, 300 winding miles below. This called for her best speed, with the result that there were stoppages from overstrain all along the way, each requiring additional make-up speed thereafter, which produced more frequent breakdowns. Caught up in this vicious cycle, her engines had become so cranky by the time she reached the mouth of the Red, 200 miles out of Vicksburg, that her substitute skipper, Lieutenant Henry Stevens, called a council of war to decide whether to continue or turn back. The decision was to press on. At daybreak, August 5th, approaching the final bend above Baton Rouge, the crew heard the boom of guns, which told that the land attack was underway. The Arkansas herself appeared to sense this, or, as one of her officers put it, like a war horse, she seemed to scent the battle from afar, and in point of speed outdid anything we had ever before witnessed. Then, just before rounding the bend, they heard a familiar sound, the crack and jar of naval guns mixed in with the bark of field artillery. The ironclad Essex and the two Farragut gunboats were adding the weight of their metal to the attempt to fling back the Confederate attackers. Urged on by the knowledge that our iron sides should be receiving those missiles which now were mowing down our ranks of infantry, Stevens decided to make an immediate ram attack on the Essex, sinking her where she lay, then steam below the city to cut off the retreat of the two wooden gunboats, reducing them to kindling at his leisure. Such was his intention, whereupon the starboard engine suddenly quit, and before the helmsman could port her wheel, the ram ran hard aground. The engineers got to work at once with files and chisels, trying to coax the balky engine into motion, but it would obviously be some hours before they could succeed. Meanwhile, the land attack continued. There lay the enemy in plain view, one of the Arkansas lieutenants afterwards wrote, still mortified years later, and we as helpless as a sheer hulk. Breckinridge had marched to within 10 miles of the place the night before in order to launch his assault on schedule, although by now he was down to 2,600 effectives as a result of sickness, brought on by the heat and an irregular diet, the rail movement having been made in such haste that commissary supplies and cooking utensils were left behind. The day before the battle we had nothing to eat but roasting ears, one Kentucky infantryman afterwards recalled, and these we ate raw because we had not time to stop long enough to roast them. Our command, with the horses, consumed 40 acres of green corn one evening, for we stopped only long enough to gather the corn and feed the horses, and we then moved forward to take position to make the attack at daylight. His brigade, which had left Vicksburg with 1,800 men, was reduced to 580 within 2 weeks. Such were the ravages of sickness, exposure, and battle, he declared. Of these, the last were the least, as the thing turned out, in spite of the fact that they found the enemy waiting to receive them. The Federal commander, Thomas Williams, had formed his line closer to the town than some of his regimental camps, contracting it thus because he was down to about the same effective strength as the attackers. Not because of exposure or bad food, but because so many of his men had still not recovered from lowland ailments encountered while plying their shovels opposite Vicksburg. However, he had the advantage in artillery, 18 pieces to 11, besides the tremendous added power of the gunboats, plowing the ranks of the charging rebels by arching their big projectiles over the capital, where a naval observer directed their fire by signals from the tower of the State House. In the face of this, Breckinridge scored considerable early success, forcing the Bluecoats back through the suburbs on the right and capturing 2 guns. But the warships, unopposed by the missing Arkansas, more than tipped the balance. By 10 o'clock, having lost the commanders of one of his 2 divisions and 3 of his 4 brigades, he halted to adjust his line. Williams, observing this, ordered a charge to recover what had been yielded, but then was killed by a bullet through his chest, the first Union general to fall in battle since Nathaniel Lyon died much the same way at Wilson's Creek,